Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Good morning. Well, we're back for our second week. Susan Arthur, can you believe we've survived 2 weeks?
We have survived and we are excited to be here.
We're on a roll. And we're going to continue talking about that topic that I know is of huge interest to a large segment of the St. Louis area population. And we try to make a point to identify topics that we think are of practical value. In other words, things that are not just theoretical, but stuff that will help you in very tangible ways. One of those tangible ways is money.
Exactly.
But we also try to do so in a entertaining, interesting way. And I knew better than to try to do this show by myself because I thought I could succeed with the first of those goals. But the second, the entertainment part, I thought, well, I don't know if I'm that interesting. And I asked some people whose opinion I trust, and they confirmed that. So I have here with me Susan Arthur, who not only is wonderfully informed on this topic and very articulate, but she's also very interesting.
Huh, I'm the comic relief, huh?
Well, relief.
Okay, there we go.
Anyway, so we have a wonderful guest today. We're going to talk about Margaret Terranova. What a wonderful name.
Thank you.
Margaret Terranova in a few moments. But before we get to that topic, I want to kind of lead into our discussion today. You know, much of the concerns we talked about, any show, in fact, that is going to purport to be helpful to people that are older, by that I mean people above 65, for example, has to think about, well, how do you pay for long-term care? And some are under the mistaken impression, Susan, that Medicare, isn't that what that's for? I mean, after all, Medicare pays for the health needs of older people. Well, it pays for treatment of and diagnosis of an illness or an injury. That's not long-term care.
No.
And that's what the system calls acute care. Chronic care or care that is custodial, that's mm-hmm. a phrase. You don't want to see that word come back in a reply letter to an application for coverage.
Right.
It's usually not going to be good news.
Correct.
So custodial care, though, is really the care that 90-95% of the people who are going to need medical care beyond in their older age are going to need that sort of care. And that means help with all those normal activities of daily living. It's really less medical. I mean, it has a medical component, but more importantly, it provides professionals who are around to help with the eating and the bathing and the transferring and all those activities, as along with some additional medical interventions. And believe it or not, Medicare will not cover you very long.
Nope.
I mean, there's some short period of time when you're covered, but beyond that, after that very short period of time, you're on your own. Now, if you're poor, there is some good news. I mean, there's not much good news if you're poor, but on this topic, there's some reasonably good news, and that's that you do have long-term care.
Medicaid.
Yes, Medicaid, and that was the voice of Margaret Terranova. She's an expert on this topic. So then we have, of course, the people who have money. Now, we know they're covered. Right? I mean, they, as they are with many things.
got the reserves.
But it's that huge bulge in the middle. I mean, we've all seen those bell curves. Well, you know that big bulge in the middle that occupies 80% of the page? That's the people who are not covered for long-term care. I mean, and I'm making a generalization. I know some people have long-term care insurance. I mean, there are some exceptions. But for the most part, to qualify for coverage, which, you know, through government support is going to be through Medicaid, not Medicare. And I'm telling you, Medicaid, if you were to simply read the rules and not the small print and the exceptions and the exceptions to the exceptions, you'd be depressed. Because if you're middle class, you would conclude, I am on my own. I'm not going to have any coverage. I'm going to be in one of those old folks' homes that we've read about from the 1950s with no air conditioning. But the reality is that when you read what appear to be very harsh conditions for Medicaid coverage, and that means if you read it, you have to be virtually broke with a few exceptions. But it turns out that with proper advice And there are professionals among them, you know, our elder law firm and other elder law firms. There are professionals who can show you ways to deal with that so that there's a very good chance that you can qualify without having to surrender all of your assets. And it's being done regularly every day. But it is a complex area. Let me hurry to add that. It's a very complex area. It's like, you know, you don't want to get tax law advice from anybody but a tax lawyer or a CPA. Mm-hmm. And similarly with Medicaid, it's just one of those subjects, unlike some areas of the law, lots of people know about. But Medicaid is in that category like the IRS code, where you've got to turn to somebody who deals with this regularly. But here's the good news. If you do investigate it, you're likely to get some very encouraging information, even if you have, say, $500,000 in assets, which is not rich, incidentally. You're in that bell curve. Because the bottom line is your house can easily add up to $200,000, you know, deferred compensation, all that. $500,000 we used to think was a ton of money. Now you barely qualify to be middle class with mm-hmm. that sort of money. But it knocks you out of the park on the general rules, and I emphasize the general rules of Medicaid. So I want you to regard this as encouraging. That there is hope, but it is something that those of you who are confronting potential health care costs and you do have some assets and you don't have a way to pay for it through long-term care insurance or other options or private resources, then there's probably a remedy for you without your having to surrender all your assets. So that's the good news. I want to shift gears, and I want to talk about a topic that our guest Margaret Terranova can chime in here and give us lots of insight as well. Something that's very important as you age, and we'll be going into a break here in a little bit, so I'm going to set the stage. Something that is very important as you age is that you designate someone to make decisions for you. Mm-hmm. And from the legal perspective, there's kind of two big categories of those decisions. One is decisions relating to financial matters and legal matters, you know, all that stuff that isn't healthcare. And those things, if you think about it, are normally made by us as adults. Once you become age 21, the law just assumes, gives you the benefit of the doubt, though some we wonder about, gives them benefit of the doubt that they're capable of making those decisions as adults. And so we all wander around as relatively free agents. And over a 40, 50 year period, we've been making those decisions on our own. Some of us have done a good job. Some of us have not done such a good job. But the bottom line is we've been entrusted with that capability. But sometimes that presumption is no longer valid, just like the presumption that we have of people who are under age 18. We assume children need someone who has the legal authority to make decisions for them. It seems like an unflattering parallel, and it's just a fact that sometimes we reach a point in life where, you know, we're no longer that independent agent that we had been for all those decades. And it's very difficult to make that transition. Once you've known that freedom and that independence and that autonomy, it's very difficult to suddenly concede voluntarily. Whoops, I think I need to hand back the reins that were handed me when I was 18 years old. So all of us, though, have really two options, and only two, as to how to deal with that situation that comes up. Number one is we can decide who that person is. There are documents we can sign, whether it's healthcare decisions, whether it's financial, legal. There are documents we can sign to take care of that. So one option is we choose the person. The other is, guess who? I mean, it's the government. And I'm not a fan of government intervention of any sort. But I can tell you that we have to all agree that when someone is wandering around as an adult and not capable of making decisions on their own, then there have to be rules in place so that they can be protected and the rest of us can be protected. So that's the alternative to signing some documents by which you can say to the world and the courts and others, I've chosen this person or these people. I want them to make decisions for me. The alternative is a court process, often litigation, means the appointment of a guardian ad litem to go and investigate, and medical records and testimony and a judge and a gavel and, as you might suspect, money, significant amount of money spent in that process. It's just terribly wasteful is the bottom line in it. And it often, or it may not certainly represent what the person's preference would have been. And I can tell you that courts themselves don't like to have to deal with the probate process used in that way, and it is probate court, it's called. So the good news is there is a happy and a very affordable alternative. There's no need to go through that process. That's the good news. We're going to go into a break in a few minutes. Then we're going to come back and we'll talk first a little bit about kind of that. We'll break it into the two parts, these two documents, as we'll call them. One is the durable power of attorney, and the durable power of attorney can deal with all those financial matters and legal matters. And then the other piece will relate to the health care. And I want our guest to chime in on this. She deals with this regularly in her practice as a nurse and a specialist in the field relating to hospice care, health care, end-of-life circumstances and decisions, health care decisions, etc. We'll be back in a few moments.
You're listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors, presented by Cordell Planning Partners, the protection you've earned. And now, attorney, CPA, Joe Cordell.
We talked before we went into the break about these two powerful documents that can mean a whole lot to many remaining years that you might have. We never know what to expect. I mean, we all want to get to the point where, and what was the I knew a biologist who referred to it as a what was it, a rectangular survival curve. In other words, the whole idea was that you're functioning normally, everything's going great, you know, you're competent, you're able physically, and then all of a sudden one day you're not. And it's over, that's it. Funeral 3 days later, the end. And I guess there's something to be said, particularly if that's a point in the distant future. But many of us don't, it doesn't happen quite that way. It's a downward sloping and sometimes only a slightly sloping curve, which means that it's difficult to know at what point, what gradation along that timeline is, have you suddenly gone from being able to not able. And it's hard to find a single point where that's true. And it's important to be sensitive to that possibility, all of us really, but some who sense that, you know, they're on this track. Either doctors have, you know, they have a diagnosis. Maybe there are other clues that they've noticed, but those signs shouldn't be ignored. And particularly from the standpoint that we're talking about this morning, and that's the steps that you can take to where you position yourself to be in the best position possible under those circumstances. And I can tell you that I can't think of anything that is more easily and more affordably addressed than the subject of identifying people, empowering them to help you in the way that you want for the balance of your life. And that occurs in two ways with two different documents. You can have the same person, incidentally, or a couple of people, or however you choose, but it should be two different documents. And one is simply called a durable power of attorney. And the word durable refers to the fact that it's still in effect when you're incompetent, which is the whole purpose. Historically, powers of attorney were no longer effective if you became incompetent. So a durable power of attorney is something that is in effect when you become incompetent under the statute in Missouri. That could be with the certification of a physician. And then there are some documents that you can have in effect immediately. So the first is called a springing, meaning it goes into effect at the moment that you're certified to be incompetent. The good news about that is you don't have someone who has power to access all your bank accounts and your retirement planning and everything else you've done. So sometimes people are uncomfortable with that, so they want something that only comes into effect, you know, when they're declared incompetent. Now, the disadvantage of that is that requires some steps and time and delay and inconvenience and sometimes some additional cost. But not a big deal if handled correctly, usually. But the other option is you simply vest someone with that power. You create a durable power of attorney. It's in effect immediately. And so that person is someone, I should emphasize, that you trust. But that's someone who has the power immediately to access all your things. It's a scary thing, but if it's a son or daughter that you know and trust, then you may feel very comfortable with that. In which case, there is no administrative and other delay to the extent that someone needed to act for you when you were not able to do that. That's a durable power of attorney. It's a wonderful document. There's not a standard form. I mean, there is a standard form, but you shouldn't approach it that way. You should have this customized to meet your particular needs. There are variations, things you can include, such as the power to make gifts to others. That's important if your intention is to do empower this person to do some last minute planning, like asset protection, like qualifying you for Medicaid, things like that. Often that means moving assets around, means changing your estate plan a little bit. That doesn't exist with a standard form. It has to be customized and designed for that purpose. And the reason it makes sense is, you know, normally you wouldn't expect that someone who gave someone a durable power of attorney would give them the power to give their stuff away to other people.
Right.
So it is a fair assumption on the part of those who draft such standard forms. But the reality is that often it makes a whole lot of sense to give that power. And if it's somebody you trust, you do probably want to give that power. So that relates to the financial and to other general matters, legal, et cetera. But then those relating to health care, it's a heading, we might call it advanced directives, because it really includes several approaches to this that exist in Missouri. There's a durable power of attorney for health care. There's a living will. There's the advanced health directive. So there are several ways to approach the problem of who makes decisions about your health care when you can't. And I want you to distinguish between and understand why this is an entirely different discussion. The person that you would entrust to handle your money, to make financial decisions for you, to handle legal affairs, you know, that's a whole different set of criteria from the person who would make those very personal, very tough decisions about your physical well-being. And that person may be strong from a nurturing standpoint, your relationship standpoint. You might have a different set of standards or criteria for that person versus the person who might do the other. Can be the same, let me emphasize. So let's bring into the discussion Margaret Terranova. And I've already told her I think that's a great name.
It is.
And let me tell you a little bit about her background. First of all, she's a registered nurse. And you're also a certified hospice and palliative nurse. Mm-hmm. That's a certification, which means you specialize in those areas.
Yes. It's an exam that you take every 4 years.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And Margaret has been working with senior adults for 22 years, five of which were in nursing homes, and 17 of those years have been at Heartland Hospice. And Heartland, it turns out, is this large organization that's national that operates and manages assisted living centers, specialized care centers, and hospice, provides hospice services, et cetera. So it's a large professional network. So we knew that this is the person to come in and talk, first of all, about the role of these advanced directives can have and what makes more sense, and advantages and disadvantages. Then also we want to sort of shift in the latter part of the show. We want to move to a difficult topic, which I don't intend and is not to be taken as a negative topic. I mean, none of us is happy with the prospect of death, you know, but we all know that it's the end of it waits for all of us. And those of us who have spiritual beliefs know that at that point, something greater lies ahead. But still, it's not. You know, it's not something we look forward to, most of us, because we're used to this world. It's familiar to us. We have our loved ones, and yet, you know, when we think about ourselves and we think about our loved ones, you know, we need to think about how to be prepared and best provide for those times when they do come. So it's in that spirit that we approach this. So first of all, Margaret, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this.
Well, I picked nursing because I liked waiting tables. It was service oriented. I could be on my feet. I could work at night. And now I work in an office from 8 to 5.
I've never heard that comparison, but go ahead.
I did not want to be a nurse growing up, but I did it. Thought, oh my gosh, I don't like it when I was in school, but I knew that I was almost finished with school and kept at it. And I never had hospice on my radar. A friend that I had worked with at the nursing home suggested it because he saw me with the people who were dying. And I also found that there were times when I knew how to say things and I wasn't sure why. I learned later they were just words that were given to me that people needed to hear. And once I started working at Heartland, I knew that that was the Supreme Court for me. I would die or retire. It's a great place. And hospice is... If you had told me, Susan and I laughed about this the other day, I said if you had told me 25 years ago that I would really, really like talking about death, I'd have said no, but I do.
I would say that somebody has to have a special mission from God for that purpose, and we're going to hear more about that. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors, presented by Cordell Planning Partners, the protection you've earned. And now, attorney, CPA, Joe Cordell.
We're back, and with my partner, Susan Arthur, who's helping me with this show, and we have this wonderful guest, Margaret Terranova. And when we went into the break, we were talking about the issue of, you know, what are these two important documents that everyone should have in place and that can be so helpful to you? And the second one was dealing with, you know, your health care. And these are called under the category, the broad category of advanced directives. And advanced directives can include a couple of different documents. One to keep in mind is the durable power of attorney is different from a living will in that you identify someone specifically that you entrust, that you empower, authorize to make these decisions for you. That's different from a living will. Compare a living will to simply a will. What is a will? A will is a statement to the world. It's not assigning it to a particular person or directing it to a particular person, but it's a statement to the world that this is the way that I want my things to be distributed, etc. Well, a living will is a similar concept. It is a declaration to any healthcare provider, anybody for whom it's important, what you want at the end. More often than not, it's dealing with end of life issues, your healthcare during that period of time. So it's not a bad idea to have both. It's a good idea generally to have a durable power of attorney for healthcare in which you've identified someone that you trust. We'll get Margaret's insight on this discussion about the choices and the decisions relating to that. It's a good idea to have that, and it's also a good idea, and sometimes these are in the same document, and that's okay too, to have a living will. And the living will is just the expression to the world, these are the things I want. Now, with that stage set, as someone, Margaret, who's dealt directly and intimately with people under the most difficult circumstances involving triggering these documents, give us the wealth of your experience and your insight regarding decisions on these documents.
It'll take about 30 seconds. I'm kidding.
Well, it's worth a lot.
I know. You're right. They are two different things. One is, who's going to make a decision for me when I can no longer make the decision? The other one is, what do I want versus what do I not want? And I'll start with that one. That's a big topic because you can say, I want absolutely nothing. You can say, well, I want absolutely everything. And then there are a lot of decisions in between there where you say, well, I want this, but I don't want that. And I'll take this, but only for a few months.
But what are the this and that? What are the options on that menu?
So the options could be CPR. The options could be dialysis. The options could be tube feeding. The options could be any kind of surgery. And within the broad category of surgery, you might say, well, I don't want a heart transplant, but gosh, if I'm early stage in dementia and I'm walking around and talking to people, just pretty forgetful, do I want to die because my appendix bursts? So there are a lot of different scenarios. The best thing, I had a physician tell me this, that you can do is talk about it. He said, your family will get tired of hearing about it, but you talk about it, talk about it, talk about it. Because when someone has to make a decision for you, it's an important thing for them to say, we know for a fact that she wanted this or she didn't want that. I remember a time when my dad was in the hospital and he was having a hard time swallowing. He couldn't eat and he kept pulling out the tube that went in the nose that was trying to give him some nutrition. They wanted to put the tube in his stomach. And my mom said, absolutely not. She said, your father will kill me if I do that. Because he had made it very clear he did not want that. And the doctors and the nurses encouraged her and said, it'll help him be stronger while he's recuperating. She said, no, he doesn't want it.
But now how did it come about that you found out that he didn't want that?
Well, I had encouraged him a few years before that to talk to us about what did he want, what did he not want. And he resisted for a while. He said, no, that's depressing. And I said, but then we might make decisions you don't want. It gives you the power if you say to us, this is what I want, this is what I not want. So when he finally agreed, he sat at the head of the table, my brother and sister and I, my brother's wife, my husband, and he said, all right, let's talk about it. And we asked him questions. If this happens, do you want this? If that happened, we asked him, and because my sister-in-law is an RN also, we asked some specific scenarios, and he made it pretty clear to us what he wanted and didn't want. So my mom knew how to honor his wishes. Even though it was also in writing, she had heard it from him, which sometimes is just as important because you hear what's in somebody's heart, you hear what somebody's desires really are.
So there's a lesson here. I mean, it's understandable that none of us want to talk about that. Mm-hmm. So I think the lesson here is sometimes we have to badger our loved ones, our parents, and others that we want this information from before they're going to sit down and, you know, undergo this unpleasant conversation.
It sounds depressing, but it really gives you the most control because you can say, I absolutely don't ever want someone to do this to me, or please, if this happens, do this. We can start exploring the decisions, and they're significant. They're based on our faith. They're based on our own health situation. They're based on what we've seen our loved ones go through. They're important decisions. It's a line in the sand that will shift as we age, as we go through things, as we learn. So these are important decisions.
Okay, back in a moment.
You're listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors, presented by Cordell Planning Partners, the protection you've earned. And now, attorney, CPA, Joe Cordell.
Smart planning for seniors. And this topic is definitely under that heading. We're talking about advanced directives. We're talking with someone who has a lot of firsthand, very intimate experience with this. It's one thing for lawyers to draft documents, and of course we do. We have very sensitive conversations with clients, and I think that they do share, you know, their most challenging struggles on this topic. But yet there's nothing like being with the family during those times. You know, it's just an immersion that gives you a special perspective. And our guest today, Margaret Terranova, has had a lot of that experience. So we're wanting to draw on that. Here's the thing, Margaret, before we went into the break, you were describing this process by which your dad, you know, with amazing wisdom, you know, finally summons the discipline to set himself down and have this, what for him, understandably, was a very unpleasant conversation. Mm-hmm. But you knew. You know, often what I see is this incredible sense of guilt and angst among family members who've made this decision, and they wonder, did I make the right decision? Mm-hmm. You know, whether it was a discontinuation of some sort of artificial support, whether it's nutrition, hydration, whatever it may have been, and they struggle with that decision, maybe for the balance of their lives, thinking perhaps they had made the wrong decision.
I think that's one of the hardest questions that's out there is, as a caregiver, I want to do what's right, but I'm not really sure what that looks like. And if mom or dad or whomever it is has not given us that information, I live with the guilt. Is this the right thing? Did I do the right thing? Did I do things too early? What is the best way to really start that process and to one, approach them, but then two, if the doctors get involved, what's the next step?
I firmly believe that if we ask the right questions, people will walk themselves right down the path where they will end up at hospice. But most people don't know that because they don't really know what hospice is. They think that hospice is a bad word. They think it means that you're dying next week, which by Medicare definition is not true. If we ask questions like, you know, every time you've come back home from the hospital, you haven't been able to do the same things that you used to do. Or every time you have another infection, it's harder on your body and it takes you longer to recover. What do you really want? Do you want to go back and forth to the hospital? Do you want to die connected to tubes? What if you only had 2 years left? What would you like those 2 years to look like? So if we start asking those kinds of questions, people will often give us the answers because most people will say they want to die at home. They want to die comfortably. They don't want to be hooked up to a lot of machines. And so when people start giving us the answers, then it leads to an easy response of, do you know that there are actually people who can help you do that, who can help you have that kind of last 6 months, last year, last couple of years? And don't freak out when I say the word to you, Mom, but it's hospice.
Well, but now let's, I want to connect these topics in a way that may not be as clear to our listeners. We were talking about the documents that you can pretty very affordably have mm-hmm. in place. And one of them we talked about earlier was, you know, definitely take care of a durable power of attorney for your financial and legal matters. The other documents we talked about, and there are several that fall under the rubric of advanced directives, relate to those healthcare decisions at the very end.
When, they do.
When you're not in a position to make those decisions. And among those, you know, can be whether you have CPR provided, whether you have artificial nutrition hydration, whether there's other artificial support provided. And as to that, you know, sometimes that means that a decision to discontinue those would be death in pretty short order to a loved one. But other times, the nature of that decision means a longer period of time. And when that longer period of time is involved, then that is, correct me if I'm wrong, Margaret, is that more often what we're talking about when we use the word hospice? Are we talking about once a decision has been made that we know death is going to occur in a fairly short order? What time frame would you say? Less than a year?
What we hope is that we get that longer amount of time with people. By definition, by Medicare's definition, hospice is for people who have 6 months or less, given the normal disease process. That given the normal disease process is because Medicare realizes some people die very quickly, some people die very slowly. Often we get people who die in the first week or so. So that leads to people assuming hospice means you're dying next week. It shouldn't. What we really want is to be able to spend months with people, because if I get a week with you, I shake your hands and introduce myself, and then you die, and then I focus on your family. So I haven't really gotten to do anything for the patient. So we hope for several months. We've actually had people be on our service for a year or 2 years, as long as they keep declining. We have to show that on paper for Medicare. But that amount of time allows us to do a lot of symptom management. It allows us to explore grief with the family. It allows us to really love on those people and pour in and help them accept what's coming.
Yeah, and so I want the audience to understand this. There are tremendous benefits that flow from an otherwise, and what is still, you know, a very difficult, unpleasant process. Mm-hmm. Still, you want to go through this in the best way possible, especially for your loved one that is most directly going through it, but also for the family. And by triggering the services of hospice, then lots of good things flow. I mean, it's like a fountain of things that you suddenly qualify for that before you made that decision, then those weren't available. And when you're having such a document prepared for you personally, this healthcare directive, you can communicate your receptiveness to this transition when certain circumstances exist.
You can. You can say in your healthcare directive that you want hospice. You can say in your healthcare directive that you want good pain management. And even verbalizing, you can say, I don't want any pain medicine. We had somebody who wouldn't take any. It was hard for our staff. Or you can say, wow. I don't care if you snow me, if I'm sleeping all the time. I don't want any pain, so give me as much medicine as it takes. You can make those choices because it's the individual person's comfort level that we most look at. Physical comfort, psychosocial comfort, and spiritual comfort, not just for the patient, but also for the family caregiver.
Okay, so now we're going to go into a break in a minute, but keep in mind, triggering hospice means a lot of benefits that were not previously covered. It means now things are paid for that were not before. Your loved one is going to be in their home in all likelihood, mm-hmm. which is probably where they want to be. Mm-hmm. They get to control a lot of things that before that was triggered, that decision, they couldn't. So this is not a bad thing when you're confronting.
It's a great thing.
It's a great thing. And we'll come back and talk more about this.
You're listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors. Presented by Cordell Planning Partners, the protection you've earned. And now, attorney, CPA, Joe Cordell.
We're talking about the subject of hospice. And I really think it's important for everyone listening to know how incredibly helpful it can be. And it's a subject that's not given much attention because it's unpleasant. And it's not the sort of subject you raise typically if you're wanting to maximize ratings for a television or a radio show. But since I don't have any ratings anyway.
Since we're new.
And we're new.
So, and I'm afraid of running off the four of you that are listening, but at that risk. we're going to, I really want to commit to teaching you more about hospice care. And we have a few minutes left. Margaret, continue the point you were making about how helpful it can be once the decision is made to take advantage of hospice.
I will. Thank you. Once their hospice comes in, you mentioned before the break that there are financial benefits. Hospice pays for certain medications and equipment and supplies. We pay for things related to comfort because the primary goal with hospice is the comfort of patient and family. So when we talk about comfort, we mean physical, psychosocial, spiritual. So we have a team of people. We have a nurse and a nurse's aide who come in a couple times a week. We have a social worker and a chaplain who come to visit. And we explore not only with patient, but also with their loved ones, because sometimes the patient is dealing with this much more easily than the caregivers are.
Yes, I can imagine that.
So we talk with the family. We help with grieving. I'll share this briefly. I asked in the community one time, people who had had an experience with hospice, and there was a nurse. I was at a hospital. She had had an experience with it with her husband, and it hadn't been a good experience. When I asked her why not, she said, I wasn't prepared for the grief, and I think we were misled about how much time my husband had left. We didn't have hospice long enough. So this was significant to me. I didn't realize it. That was the question, the answer I'd been waiting for of years of asking that question. So that's why you want hospice longer, because of exploring the grief. There's grief afterwards, so we do bereavement follow-up, but there's also grief ahead of time, especially with a dementia diagnosis. Mom doesn't remember us. Dad doesn't know my name. But also the idea of not having hospice long enough. Doctors wait till the last minute because they think families are afraid. Families wait till the last minute because they think, well, the doctor's the expert. So there's a gap that needs to be bridged.
I can see that dynamic working. The doctor's hesitant. Right. The family's thinking, well, if the doctor didn't bring it up, I'm sure not going to because I don't want to appear to be hurrying. And another thing, a point that's important is even when someone has been placed on hospice, we're quickly out of time here, but we're going to have to do this again, Margaret.
I would love to come back.
But keep this in mind, those of you listening. Even when it appears that someone does qualify for hospice and they go ahead and they have the certification from the physician and they're in the hospice status, it's always possible to shift out of it if things change. So I don't want the listeners to think that they've had a door slammed that once closed, that it's, you know, that they've really doomed their loved one to this death. And that's not it at all.
Correct.
And there's room for the miraculous. Presumably that's what it would be under those circumstances. There's room for that. But at the same time, it allows the person you care about, you know, the most in this situation to have the best possible at the very end.
Sometimes people do surprise us and they live longer. Sometimes people want to try something aggressive. Hospice should never say no. Hospice should say, we'll cheer you on and we hope it works. And then you come back to us if it doesn't.
That's the wisdom of Margaret Terranova from Heartland Hospice, who's been with us the past hour. And
thank
Margaret,
you.
You've got to come back.
I would love to.
And those of you listening, come back, all four of you. I want you to come back next week.
My brother, my sister,
yes. my
uncle, cousin,
my husband.
I have two relatives. So actually, we have a record
Almost
audience
10.
This week.
You've been listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell and sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com, eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.